Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt.
And I'm Sir Jimmy of House Nuts. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we are into Davos 4 of A Storm of Swords, my favorite book of all time. Matt, how are you doing, my friend?
I am doing pretty good. We were off last week. Jimmy was in the land of Denver for his least favorite thing of the year.
Of the quarter, every quarter, 3 months.
Your quarterly trip. And yeah, I was thinking about putting out an episode myself, and you know, this whole having a baby business, life things got in the way, to say the least. So here we are anyway. And man, this is a good chapter today. Not the one I thought it was.
Yeah. Davos is underrated, dude.
Davos chapters are definitely underrated, but because we took a break for House of the Dragon, I thought this was the chapter where I was like, oh yeah, Davos. I think this is the one where he's thrown into prison. Right. And the Melisandre comes and visits. Nope, not even close. This is the chapter where Davos gets promoted to Hand of the King. Spoilers. So
spoilers for the reread podcast. This was a great chapter. I really loved it. I think it has a lot of illuminating stuff about Stannis and who he is, but also for Davos and maybe the way forward for him. And then honest to God, I mean, I've read this series 6, 7, 8 times or whatever. I actually forgot about the end of this chapter where Stannis with King's Blood names Balon Greyjoy and Robb Stark. And I actually was like, man, this is so much more fun than I remembered it, because we know that they die, right? And also thinking about the fact that a lot of the motions to get them killed were set in motion prior to this blood deal, right? So we almost have proof that it's probably not divine. But if you are a follower of Melisandre or the Lord of Light, this looks like Davos has got to be questioning himself, right? He's got to be like, well, maybe there's something in this. But then again, he also saw a shadow fetus, so I guess that he's already pretty convinced of the power.
Certainly, yeah, he certainly sees it. I mean, there's a ton that actually happens in this chapter. Lightbringer, and it's cold to the touch. I mean, there's visions of the others. Yeah, it's pretty huge. But Jimmy, before we get going, man, how you doing? How's everything going?
you know, hey, things are pretty good. I'm a little tired, but that's kind of par for the course nowadays. But I'm excited, man. I'm excited. I feel like lately I've been reading, obviously, A Storm of Swords, which, like I said, is my favorite book of all time. But I've been reading a lot of other really good stuff. And I talked about a little bit last episode, but Tad Williams is about to release his final book in the Ostinard series, mainline series. He's going to do a couple spinoffs, but very excited. Very ready for some fall weather, even though it's the end of October. I feel like we're just getting into fall where I'm at. And I always am just like ready to read when this time of the year comes around. I'm always ready to read, but read even more, I would say. So things are good, dude. Things are really good.
Good. Yeah. Good. Let me just say that I think I speak for everyone in the United States of America as we sit here and say that I'm ready for the election to be over.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to blank it out of my mind.
My phone literally is going off as you're talking, and I just get spam calls about the election left and right, and I'm just so over it.
Yeah,
the only politics I want to care about are the Westerosi politics.
Okay? Well, there's a lot of them right here. A lot of betrayers and treason talked about in this chapter. Who can be trusted but Justin Onion Knight?
Yeah, which is, man, I love
Davos, dude.
Yeah, but I know we have a lot of listeners from around the world, but let me tell you, America's election season, geez, it is just nonstop, 24/7, ads here, ads there. I get text messages from both sides because I have an Ohio phone number. And
my old Pennsylvania phone number gets destroyed, dude.
I know. If I have, and then even our local stuff, I haven't even looked them up yet, right, to see like what the deal is. And it's just, in Oregon, we get a vote by mail, which is great. In Ohio, you had to go. And some people probably like, as you should, I have to go down there. I like voting by the mail because then I can look and I can
do your research and stuff, which is cool. So get out there and vote, folks.
Yeah, get out there and vote. Just
the quicker we vote, the quicker these stupid calls will stop.
Exactly. I'm tired. I used to be pretty political and I used to be real into it. Now I just think both sides are evil and corrupt and I just don't really care anymore.
But Matt, we're feeding into it. We're talking about it.
I know.
This is supposed to be a safe space for A Song of Ice and Fire fans, and we're over here just, do you think, and also, I mean, shout out to Uganda, one of our number one countries.
For absolutely. Kenya. Kenya, all those other countries. That
they're like, what are you talking about?
They're probably like, you guys, I mean, yeah, well, election season, at least better here than it is there, I guess, you know.
I don't know that for a fact. I have no idea.
I don't know.
It's probably a lot worse, honestly, here. Maybe at this point. But I mean, one thing that we can always come together on is the fact that we love Davos.
Absolutely.
We love Davos chapters.
Yeah. And let me just go ahead and we'll dive in here and talk about it. Because the only politics I want to talk about is, you know, there is some unrest in Westeros. There's a lot of kings. All these people. I should be king. Well, as far as I'm concerned, there is only one true king of Westeros.
Who's that, Matt?
That is Stannis the Manus Baratheon. Okay?
You know how many times I've seen like posts and videos and essays and stuff being like, can we please stop the Stannis the Manus narrative? And the answer is no. We cannot stop
he is by right the one true king of Westeros.
There's a strong argument that he should have inherited that throne, I think.
There is a strong argument. It's truth.
It's the argument.
There is no other argument. Robert Baratheon took the throne from the Targaryens. That he is king. So, I mean, yeah, John and Danny are out there and they have to take it back. But I mean, he took it. That's just how it works. All right. There was Native Americans here and we came and took their land. Was it right? I don't know. But I mean, that's how it works. It's just like Rome. They conquered all those places and Persia conquered all those places and England and everybody. Egypt and everybody throughout history conquered everybody. And that's just how it works. You take the land and it's you know, not saying it's right, but it's how it works. Then you are the rightful ruler. Robert said, I'm taking the throne, and he did. So he is the ruler. Okay. And the law says that it's supposed to pass to his first trueborn heir, which he doesn't have one, meaning his true rightful heir is Stannis the Manus Baratheon.
Well, it is interesting to think about, you know, what is law or what is right or whatever. But then on the flip side of that, to think about an effective leader, it's like one of those. And that's the thing. Like, life is so gray and nuanced in this manner where it's like, well, yeah, this person absolutely should be, like, by all intents and purposes, we see it. We're like, this person should be in charge. This person should be the winner. And then something comes along that feels like maybe a cult of personality or has different value, whatever it might be. And then we're saying, well, we, like, this person lacks these things. So even though they're supposed to be the one in line, we're actually going to go this other way. And this is the big thing with Stannis, right? And Stannis admits this in this chapter. Robert had an uncanny ability to make his enemies his friends, to slay their brothers at night or in the morning and then drink with him at night in the halls. And in some ways, actually gives us a lot more context about Robert Baratheon, because to this point in the series, we kind of look at Robert Baratheon as a complete mess up, right? A drunken, whoring king. Yeah, well, I love me some Bobby B. All right, I'm not speaking treason. He's right behind me. But I am definitely of the opinion that to this point in the series, we're kind of supposed to look down on Robert's reign. Whereas Stannis shows maybe not a positive about his reign, but how he became king. And positive traits, right? Being able to, I guess, to put an American spin, reach across the aisle, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to reach across the aisle. Well, Robert Baratheon was reaching across, you know, the shield wall and shaking hands with people that he was literally destroying with Warhammer, which is insane to think about. And it kind of gives like, oh, Robert did have some traits. He didn't just luck into this thing. He didn't just take it by force, right? He actually had some political maneuvering and some charm to him that Stannis lacks totally. But I'm going to give Stannis some credit here. The fact that Stannis takes an onion knight in front of all these lords and elevates him and is like, you know, you're the only one that will tell me how it is. Like, that's actually an amazing quality of a leader. And not looking at Davos's class, basically looking at his deeds, right? Very black and white. I have a friend who loves the Song of Ice and Fire who is on the spectrum of the autism spectrum. And he says that he feels like Stannis is a really good representation of some of the people who are on the spectrum with their very black and white thinking. And Stannis is very much like, this is good, this is bad. We weigh it out and that's the answer. Like, there is no in between of these things. Like, all the good doesn't wash away all the bad doesn't wash away all the good. It's like individual deeds to be judged. And I think that that's pretty true for the most part. So Stannis, even though he's cold, which is ironic because he's up in the north, but I think that he does have some sense of honor, right? Like a Ned Stark. I mean, he's so by the book that he actually thinks that Ned Stark wasn't the greatest guy in the world, right? He's kind of petty. He holds grudges, maybe that's not honorable. Stannis is just a fascinating character. And here's the point about the Stannis the Manus thing that I go with. I think the story is just a lot more interesting with Stannis in it. And maybe people don't feel that way because he's so black and white and so like stern. But I think he's a pretty fascinating character and he always makes it feel complicated.
Yeah, no, Stannis is amazing. And you don't, I mean, it's one of the things where like these Davos chapters give us an insight to him, much like the Catelyn chapters give us an insight to Rob, because otherwise you wouldn't really get a ton of Stannis Baratheon except like sort of hearing about him. So you do also, I appreciate that we get Stannis through Davos's eyes.
Yeah,
because definitely. Davos sort of views him as honorable and all of these things. And so then I don't know, maybe it's just the way George frames Stannis is when he does talk about actually why he likes his brother and had respect for his brother and things like that, where Stannis is like, I don't even really want to be king.
Yeah,
I mean, he like in this chapter, he talks about, you know, like Robert is more suited for this than me.
Yeah. And I think that this is like I said, this is a very important moment, not just for our context of Robert, but like for Stannis. He's willing to admit the positives of his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's almost like mesmerized by the fact, maybe mesmerized, not the word, but shocked at how Robert was able to have these relations with lords that he was battling against just a day before. And it is, I mean, that's the kind of like once in a family tree kind of thing happening of having someone with that much charisma. Though Renly also was pretty charismatic in my opinion.
Yeah.
It just seemed like he did not garner as much respect as Robert because Robert was also swinging a Warhammer on a battlefield in the very like masculine culture of Westeros. So I think that this shows like Stannis having some self-awareness. And that goes a long way for a guy who's so black and white about everything.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, let's dive into the chapter today, which is chapter 36, Davos 4. Mm-hmm. Axel Florent brings Davos Seaworth before King Stannis Baratheon, taking the torch with him to leave his brother Alistair alone in the darkness of the cells. Axel tells Davos in private that he has seen Stannis' victory in the flames, and if Davos does not help him become Hand, he will see the Onion Knight killed. Stannis proclaims that Alistair will die for treason, and he has Axel tell Davos of his plan to invade Claw Isle. Davos calls the plan a folly, and Stannis dismisses the enraged Axel. Stannis mentions that Barristan Selmy once told him that the rot in King Aerys' reign began with Varys, and that Robert should have killed the eunuch and sent Jaime Lannister to the wall as Lord Eddard Stark had suggested, but Robert listened to Jon Arryn instead. Stannis then raises Davos to Lord of the Rainwood, Admiral of the Narrow Sea, and his new Hand of the King. When Stannis mentions battle, Davos mistakes him to mean the continuance of the war, but Melisandre has entered the room and calls it the Great Battle. Soon comes the cold and the night that never ends. Stannis has also seen a vision in the flames of men in black with torches on a high hill in the forest during snow. While all around them shapes were moving, Melisandre proclaims that Westeros must unite under King Stannis in order to defeat the one whose name who must not be spoken. Stannis takes three leeches fat with the blood of Edric Storm. Melisandre tells him that this is not the best way, for it both will and will not work. The better way is to sacrifice Edric to the flames, for there is power in King's blood. Melisandre believes that his death will wake the stone dragon, as prophesized, and the sacrifice of one life to save thousands of others is warranted. But Stannis will not hear of it. Stannis tosses the leeches one at a time into a brazier, naming each of the false kings, Joffrey Baratheon, Balon Greyjoy, and Robb Stark. Yeah, this is a massive chapter, to be entirely honest. Like,
yeah, it's humongous. I mean, we have obviously would you agree that the Night's Watch on a hill surrounded by moving Fist of the First Men, possibly, that mm-hmm. that we've kind of already seen, or maybe it's a more of a future scene that we might see in the battle? I don't know, but I'm sure people probably feel like it's the Fist of the First Men. I think I do,
right,
at this point, but who knows? If we get wins, maybe we'll see something else. But with this chapter, you see a line that Stannis is not willing to cross. And we know that he will cross a line that he'll never come back from in Winds of Winter, which is sacrificing his daughter. We know that. Now, when I say we know this, what I mean by that is one of the three oh shit moments that George shared with Dave and Dan was the fact that Robert would be sacrificing his daughter. So that actually came from George. Now, George has said things have changed completely ever since the show aired and he's started writing more. So maybe that's out. Maybe Stannis, I think Stannis is actually probably going to have a way more revised role with the changes. I think he's one of the characters that most likely George is going to do more with than he planned to. But I don't know that for a fact. So the information we actually have access to, in the words of George, Stannis is one day going to cross a line he can't. But at this point in the story, he's not willing to cross certain lines. Now we have to start thinking about what gets Stannis to the point of wanting to sacrifice that. Obviously, where we leave him in A Dance with Dragons, he's in a horrible spot. And I mean, almost dead. I mean, he's at rock bottom at the end of A Dance with Dragons. So I think that might be the moment where he kind of tips over the edge. But we also see in this chapter that Melisandre has wider ambitions and is truly concerned about the whites coming or the winter coming. She is seeing this. And for a story that's about this existential threat, it's kind of ironic that, you know, so much of it is actually centered around human politics. And one of the only people mentioning this huge fight that's coming is Melisandre, who at this point in the story, I don't think we're supposed to like very much. But George has also said she's the most misunderstood character in the series. So a lot of character work is done here, and it's quite beautiful. And Davos is consistently saying that he would never turn his back on Stannis, that he'll do what's right or whatever. And it's my belief, and Matt, I'd love your take on this. I think that there's a strong possibility that Davos will be in direct contact with the downfall of Stannis. I know people think Brienne killing Stannis is a thing. That's fine. And that probably will be it. But I think we're going to see Stannis cross a line and then Davos with his unrelenting loyalty being questioned. And he will see something that he just cannot support Stannis with. Right. I mean, he is so abject to Melisandre and her religion, but he still follows Stannis because he believes in Stannis that much. Do you think that Davos could possibly have a hand in Stannis's end?
Man, it's so tough because anytime we talk about Stannis, it's he to me is the biggest block in Winds of Winter, because there's so many events that seem like they're going to happen, or they all hinge on all of Winds of Winter hinges on the opening few chapters, I think, with Stannis. And I think it's the reason it's taken George as long as he has. We've talked about other characters, but I mean, it all depends on what you want to do with him. And we've talked about this literally for years at this point, because taking what we know happened sort of in the show and even things that seem like they could happen in the books, like the Battle of the Bastards might not even happen in Winds of Winter.
We don't know.
That might be a show only thing. The pink letter gets sent, but it just Stannis is so different than show Stannis, in that a lot of the events that we see happen, like in the show, none of that is there to justify, like Brienne, for example.
Yeah.
Well, Brienne is sort of right place, right time to kill Stannis in the show, because Brienne is sort of there to help actual Sansa escape.
Yeah.
From Renly, causing, as Jon Snow is resurrected, to, you know, kick this whole
Ramsay
thing.
Not Renly. I can't let,
sorry.
Yeah, I can't Ramsay. Let you slander.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Ramsay. Exactly. Yeah. Ramsay to, you know, have all of those events take place at the same time. But the problem is that none of those things are set up right now. Like Sansa is not in the north escaping Ramsay and Winterfell to run to Jon Snow, who's about to be resurrected. And I mean, we still have to see. So Stannis could still go try and fight Ramsay at Winterfell and lose. And maybe he just dies there, and then you sort of take away the Brienne piece of it. Because Brienne's like way far away. She's nowhere close to where she is in the show.
Yeah, she's going to be going on a journey, most likely.
Yeah, I don't she might not even see him. So if you do that, then does Stannis just take out, like, and this is another reason why I think Battle of the Bastards could potentially not happen, is Stannis could just beat Ramsay. And Ramsay's whole purpose could have been to write the pink letter to get John killed.
Possibly. I mean, we're not sure, right?
Right. But I mean, if Ramsay and Roose Bolton, who's still alive, by the way, were to die and Stannis takes Winterfell, the pink letter would have ultimately served its main purpose, which is to get John to say, hey, we need to go do this stuff to betray the night, sort of, you know, betray the Night's Watch to them to kill him to set up his resurrection.
Yeah.
That could be the piece, because like Sansa's nowhere close to being able to even leave with an army with the Knights of the Vale. I mean, I think young Griff is still coming over. So it's still always like the big block as to what's going to happen.
Yeah. And then, to get back to like the Davos piece of this, right? So like, let's just say, let's run with what you're saying, and Stannis ends up taking Winterfell, right? And he wants to maybe give it to Jon or something like this. But if Stannis takes Winterfell because of a sacrifice of his daughter, maybe Davos is the one to undercut him, possibly. And right. And George loves the human heart and conflict with itself, love and duty, these things. So I feel like Davos having history with this family, and then Stannis doing the unthinkable, I think could actually lead to Davos having a hand in Stannis's final demise. I think it's a pretty compelling storyline. Also, I know a lot of people.
Real quick, I'm trying to remember here. In the show, why Davos is not there when Shireen is burned? Where is he at?
I do not recall from the show, to be honest.
Because he doesn't go meet with Manderly and then go meet. I don't think he goes searching for Rickon. I think they find out. I think Ramsay finds out that Rickon is there because he says, "I have your brother and I have these other." Like that's part of the thing. Mm-hmm. That's part of the thing but Rickon is not in the book Pink Letter.
I remember so little from the show post season four, to be honest with you.
Because if that event still kind of happens where Ramsay say gets Rickon, now he's got another piece of the puzzle because he actually had like if he intercepts Davos though, then he would have Davos kidnapped, and that could be something that helps lure Stannis out. And maybe that's, I don't know, a piece of the puzzle. And now it's Stannis who loses because of, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Melisandre who's still there. There's a lot I actually still want to talk about with Melisandre and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, it's still the Davos or the Stannis stuff is still like the biggest block that you just have to go one way or the other. And it just depends on what George ultimately wants to do. And if you look at a lot of the language he's used in talking about Winds of Winter, Stannis is almost one of the people he never talks about. He's like, "Oh, I've worked with Cersei chapters and Arya chapters, stuff like that." I think it's the hardest part.
Yeah, it could be. Also, might be where a lot of the changes are coming in because he's saying more and more is changing. So, like, you know, I'm sitting here saying that the burning is confirmed because George said it was, but again, that could have changed. What I will say
I do think that's still going to happen.
I've seen a lot of people say that it's an unrealistic thing and that Stannis would not do this. However, you have to realize that the power of magic and its influence in the perception that you have around you of what it's accomplishing is in direct correlation with like your next moves using it. So what I'm trying to say is that at the end of this chapter, Stannis says these three people will die and then they die. Okay. Now he's going to be at rock bottom and Melisandre is going to say, "If we can burn your daughter, we will accomplish this thing."
Yeah, which,
and then he looks at the sunken cost fallacy and he thinks, "We've come this far, we know it works, I have to do this." I mean, like, that's a tough thing, dude.
Which, by the way, I want to talk about, because, you know, she first of all, I do like that Davos points out in here he doesn't say the boy's name.
Mm-hmm.
So it just says the boy. It's almost like Stannis is kind of even like needs to take that piece away from it, even though he is his uncle, right? It's
human psychology.
It's his nephew. Yeah. But it kind of got me thinking about like blood magic and King's blood, which we've talked about before. Is it possible that somebody like a Melisandre would talk about how King's blood is more valuable just because the people you're always going to be telling it to are going to believe that King's blood is more valuable than regular blood magic? Mm-hmm. Or is it sort of the person whose blood you're using? Right. Is that like, if you do blood magic on, say, like an old, you know, somebody at like the Night's Watch who was just like a terrible person who just got sent to the Jimmy, let me tell you a story. If you remember last year, I went to Italy, and on my trip to Italy, I accidentally got stuck in Spain. The flight I was going through got delayed in England, and I had to go to Madrid for a night. And let me tell you, as someone who doesn't speak Spanish, that was very difficult. Thankfully, my wife does, but I think it's probably high time that I learn some Spanish, because you literally never know when you may need it.
And there's only one option if you're going to be learning a foreign language, and that is Rosetta Stone. As the world's most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app, it truly immerses you in the language that you would like to learn.
Rosetta Stone is a trusted expert for nearly 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and more.
And we're talking about fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. I mean, for one, no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and most importantly, think in that language. It's an intuitive process that helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, and of course, to sentences. It's designed for long-term retention.
And they've got speech recognition, a built-in true accent feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent.
And we're talking about how convenient this app is all the time. Flexible learning, anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with mobile app or on your desktop on your own schedule.
And it's an amazing value. They have a lifetime membership that has all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages you need in life. That's lifetime access to all 25 courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off. I mean, that's a steal. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Bend the Knee listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Wall and you know, like a frail human being as opposed to somebody who's like young and strong. Is there a difference there as well? But if you're talking to a king and you're telling them that king's blood is more valuable, I feel like they're more likely to believe that.
Yeah, I think it's cliche or propaganda or whatever we want to put a label on it. I don't think it's actually true, especially because Beric Dondarrion seems to be so special, right? And Beric Dondarrion, for all intents and purposes, is like a midlord. Like he's not a king at all, right? And we also see fantastical elements happen all throughout the series without King's blood being involved. So I think it's just one of those things of like, it's an interpretation of what's going on in the fantastical, but it's not concrete. Now, with that said, it does seem like certain bloodlines do end up having dreams, right? We have dragon dreams, we have green dreams. Bran is related to the first men like way, 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 way long ago. So there's a whole lot of question marks around it. I think we're supposed to make that question is supposed to be asked in our brains as we read. Does King's blood actually matter? I think the answer is probably not. That's my gut feeling, especially since the fact that Stannis is going to get a bunch of confirmation bias here when these three people die using King's blood. When in reality, like I said, all these deaths have kind of already been set into motion prior to the King's blood being used. Rob Stark was dead. He's not physically dead, but his death certificate has been signed already. Way before they did this.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And even Joffrey's, and I have some Reddit threads here, people I thought had some good things I could pull up too, because like we could talk about like why maybe Stannis shouldn't even have done this in the first place. But it kind of got me thinking, you know, because you could argue that if Stannis does burn Shireen, which we, you know, seems likely, unless George has undergone some major rewrite, that Stannis is also committing kinslaying, which could be part of the thing that is his downfall. Now, Melisandre must not think it's all that important. And this is where you can kind of view her as maybe, I guess, evil in a way, is for her, it's obvious that the Great War is the only thing she's concerned about.
Yeah, do the ends justify the means, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Because to her, she knows the real threat that's coming, which is the White Walkers and the others. And so for her, I don't think she actually cares about Stannis or cares for Stannis. You know,
this is why she'll probably switch to Jon Snow eventually. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Is that she'll then look at John and think John is the prince who is
Lightbringer.
Right, which is mentioned in here, but yeah, kind of, it's just kind of interesting. So she may, clearly she must not think that kinslaying is that big of a deal, because even killing Edric Storm would be kinslaying.
It would. And, but what's a little kinslaying to save the world, Matt? Sometimes you gotta.
Right. I mean, but yeah, I mean, it could backfire, because if you're doing, does kinslaying just come back to haunt you at any point, or does it have something to do with the reason of why you did it?
Yeah, right. I mean, that's a great question.
Because Tyrion's going to have to face that.
Yeah, he is. And but here's the thing, right? So if I came to Portland and murdered you, right, that would be a bad thing. I think we could all agree for the most part. Besides British Airways, I think they would be happy for me to silence a doubter. But if I came and murdered you right now, it would be a bad thing. But if I drove to Portland and I happen to have a, I don't have a brother, but if I had a brother and he lived next door and I dropped in and I killed him too, that would be considered worse.
Right.
But at the end of the day, like, the actual act is the same.
It is.
But it is a like conscious human element added to it, that we know that these things are tied and we're supposed to be family. So I think that's the exact same case as it is in Westeros. Some people are going to find it to be really bad, no matter what. Some people are going to find that kinslaying is worse, and it's all kind of dependent on what people decide to tolerate, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah. Well, let me pull up something else. I want to shift gears here just a little bit with that, but kind of the same thing is, at one point in this chapter, they were talking about like remaining loyal to your king and all of these things. And Davos, I think this is one of the reasons Stannis is like, all right, I'm with him, because Davos is at least telling me what's true.
Yeah.
But they're talking about like how treason and all of these things like is one of the worst things you can do, like almost as if it's offending the gods. But Davos calls Stannis out. Right. And he says, it is a man's duty to remain loyal to his rightful king, even if the Lord he serves proves false. Stannis declared in a tone that brooked no argument. A desperate folly took hold of Davos, a reckless akin to madness, as you remained loyal to King Aerys when your brother raised his banners. Shocked silence followed until Sir Ackle cried treason, then snatched the dagger from his sheath. Your grace, he speaks his infamy to your face. Davos could hear Stannis grinding his teeth, a vein bulged blue and swollen in the king's brow. Their eyes met. Put up your knife, Sir Axel, and leave us. And then, he leaves, and then Melisandre comes in. You're thinking, uh-oh, Davos might get burned. But I think that's the moments where Stannis realized Davos is the guy I need.
This is where his black and white thinking is good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it is still like, yeah, you did. I mean, you're sitting here talking about like, oh, you know, the things you should, like we're talking about the gods and kinslaying and all these things. Mm-hmm. Is that something where maybe that comes back to haunt you? Where, I mean, Stannis says you should always obey your lord no matter what happens. And then he goes on to talk about how it was a hard decision. And he then begins to view it as, do I go with my brother or do I go with my king?
Yeah, man. And kind of shocking.
And the funny thing is that he chooses his brother, which is his family. Exactly. But then it's almost like he doesn't want to kill Edric Storm, even though he has put him off to being a boy.
Right.
But later is going to make the decision to kill his daughter, which is the ultra broken. This is what we have to do.
And this is why I love A Song of Ice and Fire, not because of the kid murdering. Obviously, that's horrible. Sure. But it's the journey down this rabbit hole that Stannis has went through, from a guy as black and white as he is choosing to go with his brother, at the end of the series choosing to sacrifice his daughter. And he is pushed there by a narrative that he deserves power and that the power is his rightfully, whether he wants it or not, he needs to take it. So one of it is his black and white thinking mixed with the idea of being in power. And then on top of that is this extreme view of religion that's telling him that he is divine, that he is a light bringer, that he's a Azor Ahai. Like, these things are all meshing with his personality, which is sometimes good, sometimes bad, but is very black and white. And you see how someone kind of loses themselves. And it is so sad when you think about it as a whole. Like whenever you hear that, yeah, Stannis took his brother's side, it almost warms your heart a little bit. You're almost like, yeah, stick with your brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that same man will one day burn his daughter.
Whew. Yeah, I know. And that's, I think that's the, his ultra tragedy. I think that's why a lot of people,
what a story,
right? I think that's why now a lot of people like Stannis, because he hasn't done that yet.
This is how absurd A Song of Ice and Fire is, dude. Like me and you were sitting here talking about this. We could probably talk about this for like 10 episodes. That is one storyline in this story. You know what I'm saying? Like someone could have written a fantasy series about just Davos, Stannis, and Melisandre. And we would have said, oh, that's epic fantasy. That's sick. And George's like, that's one of 36 storylines I have going on right now. That also intertwines with all of those other storylines somehow. What a ridiculously good series. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Something I'm trying to pull up here. Okay, right here. All right. So this is something kind of interesting here. I just wanted to pull up here. I want to make sure I'm in the right chapter. Okay. Just a small little detail I noticed. And again, I'm going to be kind of shifting gears here just a little bit. But when they're talking about going to Claw Isle, because then Davos begins, once he makes him Hand of the King, he begins to give him like actual thing, because they want to go take out Lord Celtigar, who sort of said, and that's what kicked off the whole argument, was treason and all of the things. But when they're talking about what's at Claw Isle and Lord Celtigar has, something kind of caught my attention that, like, wow, I never even thought about that. I think you know what I'm talking about here. Mm-hmm. But they talk about, so Claw Isle was lightly garrisoned, its castle reputedly snuffed with mirish carpets, Valanti glass, gold and silver plate, jeweled cups, magnificent hawks, and an axe of Valyrian steel, which one is kind of cool because that's one of the first things we hear about. That's like besides a dagger or something like that. A horn that could summon monsters from the deep, chest of rubies, and more wines than a man could drink in 100 years. So you actually have like really two deep level things there. One, a horn that can summon monsters from the deep. Maybe that is something we think. And you always got to keep in, any time you hear about the horns that are supposed to be able to do things, I think you should always kind of keep our eyes open to it. Maybe that's right. Some people think we're going to see a kraken. Right,
I hope so. I love krakens,
but it is next to immediately a chest of rubies, which we also know George loves the color code and the gemstone code and all those things, and rubies is tied to glamoring, which means falsehood and all those things. So maybe that's saying that horn is not,
that horn isn't really there. That's what right. I was about to say. I said maybe there's too many horns, maybe someone's lying, you know.
Right, but so it's just immediate that George does put it right up there, maybe just to throw you off of it. But we don't really hear of that many horns that houses hold. That, I mean, they have an axe of Valyrian steel, so immediately you literally already have one magical item. Like, we know that's legit.
Yes,
like the Valyrian steel sword is, we know, against the White Walkers and stuff, it will cut them, it will kill them, we know that for sure. So that's a legit magic item. Then a horn that seems like it might be magical, and then a chest of rubies. Like, just, that's just George being George. Like,
some George writing. Some George writing, though, would be if we hear about this magical horn of this, you know, island with all these rubies, and it's all flashy and ends up being fake. Euron has a horn, ends up being fake, and then the real horn that has actual powers is sitting in the hands of Sam the Slayer, of Samwell Tarly. Like, that's such a George thing. Like, the unlikely of event. That this
right, I guess, do you think, and we this is, you know, not gonna go totally off the deep end here, but do you think there are two magical horns? Like, do you think Dragonbinder and the Horn of Winter exist, or do you think maybe there's just only one magical horn?
Well, I'm a big fan of the swap theory that me and you've talked about before,
right?
I think it's a pretty cool theory. I would not be shocked if there's only one magical horn, and that Sam is the one in possession of it and doesn't actually know, because Euron being false feels likely to me. Like, a lot of what he is saying is, you know, him just building this cult of personality. And then any other horn that were mentioned, like, unless if there were more of a reason to believe in this horn we're reading about in this chapter, I almost feel like it's George just, you know, writing stuff.
Right.
But who knows?
Yeah, I mean the dragon binder, right? I mean, I'm pretty sure somebody opens that. Yeah, I mean, so somebody does blow that horn, and yeah, in Feast for Crows, yeah, and their like lungs turn to black. So we do know there's something going on with that horn.
Yeah,
whether or not it's actually going to be dragon binder or not.
Yeah, and who knows if that is like a trick,
right?
right?
Poison in it or something.
Yeah, yeah. Who in all set up for this to happen? I don't. Now I sound like a conspiracy theorist against Euron, but these are the questions that we have to answer. But I do think it's a very George thing to have if Sam were the one to actually hold the only horn that mattered. Could you imagine if Sam in Old Town up against Euron, and Euron blows his horn, and then Sam blows his, and Sam's actually does something? You know, like that would be so ironic.
Yeah.
I'm just a big Sam Well fan. I want him to have all the moments in the series.
I am too. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the leeches and the naming people. So somebody pulls this up. This is from the Song of Ice and Fire reread subreddit, which I really like because they go through like they've gone through like cycles over the decades, right? That they've been doing that at this point that it's going on. And so you get people like in different time, you know, like this is from like 4 years ago. But so somebody saying, he said, the three leeches is one of those scenes that I feel barely comes up in discussion. We know the reason the three kings die. And with the exception of maybe Balon, these plans were in motion long before the events of this chapter. So is it just coincidence? After all, Melisandre did note that it would be safer to use the boy. Instead of that, I kind of want to talk about a strategic aspect of the scene. If the objective of the three leeches was to truly kill the three kings, I'd like to ask Stannis one question. Are you insane? Joffrey is despised by everyone around him. Stannis should be overjoyed to have him sit the throne. All killing him does is replace Joffrey with the far more amicable Tommen. Why not go for Tywin instead? Even Arya figured that one out. Balon is just why. Sure, killing him will force the Ironborn to retreat from the north and crown a new king, but Stannis is on the opposite side of them. All killing him does is remove another potential threat for the Lannisters. Now, it would make sense if Stannis would ally himself with Robb, but we know he doesn't want to. Robb the third and final leech. With this move, Stannis would cripple the only noteworthy foe the Lannisters have left, allowing them to complete dominate the war, which is exactly what happened. Regardless of the leech plan actually did something or not, I'd say this is the single most idiotic move in the entire story.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of far more idiotic moves, actually.
I don't think it's the most idiotic
move. I understand looking at it from this lens and like finding something that no one has said makes you feel like this is actually, but no, I think there's far more idiotic things. With that said, it's not the smartest move in the world, but for someone who's been beat down and scorned and is feeling it, I think that it's not inexcusable to feel brash or maybe not that surprising. Stannis also is looking at it like a power vacuum. Balon gets killed. They go back to the Iron Islands. That's actually a huge deal. Getting the Ironborn back to their island, fighting within themselves is actually smart. I don't think that the Balon assassination is bad. The Robb one, I think, is probably the one that makes the least amount of sense in many ways because Robb just wants to be king in the north. And Stannis could have that talk with him whenever he wanted or he could battle him or whatever. I think the Robb one comes from a place of emotion and being scorned and not being helped by Robb. I think that bothers him a lot. So that one probably feels the most petty. But the thing about Joffrey is very hated, and you could say that it could cause unrest or whatever, but he's also unpredictable. And that is a really scary foe to go against, because when you're not sure what they would do, it's hard to plan your next move. But on top of that, if Joffrey were to die, Tommen is a small child in the book, right? And the idea being that if there's a small boy, no one respects it, more ripe for the taking, people will see that Tywin's actually behind the throne, maybe he'll become regent. I think that you can make an argument that you're better off having Joffrey there and killing Tywin. I think killing Tywin is probably the smartest move, but I think that there's at least some logic to the idea of having Tommen become the heir and then, you know, having to sit, being so young, no one taking it serious, power vacuum comes in, Stannis, hero. So I still think that it's kind of explainable. I'm not saying it's the smartest move, and maybe it's a blunder. Maybe I'll even give it to it. It's a blunder, but it's certainly not the biggest blunder in the series, I don't think.
Yeah, I also think, I mean, maybe he just thinks that by killing all these people, he can immediately just be the only one left and everyone's going to say that. So I don't know.
Yeah.
He also just lost a big battle against Joffrey.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I see that. I do somewhat see the idea of if you really want to wait it out and everything, especially since you're going north anyway, like that's kind of the thing that's kind of weird is he decides to make this decision now and mm-hmm. say, okay, well, I'm going to do this and then go fight the others. I mean, why would you use the leeches to kill everyone and then go fight the others when you could just go take King's Landing and then build a massive army to then go fight the others?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the weird thing about the timing and everything, especially because he just used the leech against, well, he didn't use it. Well, yeah, he did. The leech against.
Well, he doesn't really have the means to fight at King's Landing right now.
You know? Right. Because he just lost. But he did use magic to go kill Renly, and we know that worked.
It did.
So
that one straight up worked, by the way. Like that's the weird thing. Like these leeches, we can explain why it isn't real magic, but like the shadow baby's really magic.
Straight
right?
up work.
Like straight up, it was very effective.
Yep. Straight up work. 100%. No issues whatsoever.
Yeah, that one, like, and that's like when I hear people say, oh, there's actually no magic in A Song of Ice Fire. It's all illusions. And I'm like, no. There was a shadow fetus.
Basement magic is also legit. We know.
Very legit. Yeah. And that's what makes the series kind of
fun. There's also dragons.
Yeah. And we're supposed to be questioning these things at all times. We're supposed to say, well, did the leeches really work?
And we also see people, you know, attack White Walkers and it doesn't do anything with normal weapons. And then they attack them with special weapons.
Magical,
and they do
work. Yeah. The obsidian.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what makes it a fantasy and kind of fun in many ways.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, it's just interesting. It is interesting to talk about, like, well, you know, had he not done that, all of those things. Plus, I agree with you about the Balon Greyjoy being the one that makes the most sense because they're also hard to fight.
They're very hard to fight. And they're good at what they do.
A lot of people don't have a navy. He just lost his navy.
I mean, look at what's happened to the North while Rob's been gone. And Rob's saying, we got to go back. I mean, this is right. Like big stuff. Now, obviously, with the Bolton, we know that. But I think people kind of sleep on the Greyjoys a little bit. Like, they think that they're almost like jokes. But there's a reason why they're always considered in the small councils. And yes, they may not be able to take King's Landing. But they can mess stuff up pretty bad. Even in House of the Dragon, right? We keep hearing about the Red Kraken over and over and over again at these councils. And they're kind of like, like we'll handle it. Well, eventually it's going to come to a bit of a head and they're going to really have to handle it at some point. But I think the Greyjoys deserve a little bit more respect as a force to cause disarray. Cause that's what they do. And they're very good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. It isn't also like one of the things that you kind of forget about is like, okay. And this is why you have to kind of read all, you know, all the chapters and everything, but like, okay, well now they're saying we're going to go north. Well, if you think about what's going on at North, John's up there. He's with the Gret and everything. They're getting ready to attack the wall and everything. And so that is one of the coolest scenes is when
here comes the cavalry and it's Stannis.
Yeah. Stannis shows up like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot about that. Cause I don't think if I look, I don't even think you have another chapter for quite a bit.
I think that here comes the cavalry is one of the few that has actually caught me off guard. Like when I first read it and it happened,
because it feels like it comes out of nowhere, even though because Davos is chapter 36. That might be. Let's see here. Davos. Yeah, you don't see Davos again until chapter 54.
Dang.
Yeah. So I mean it's a ways. And then immediately followed by a John chapter. So I think that's it. I think.
Yeah.
Let's see. So what happens here? So the next Davos chapter, which is a ways away, is Davos is you're going to be beginning to learn how to read, right? Mm-hmm. So that's still another one. And then, yeah, they're going to begin their mission of the in the dark of night, Edric Storm. I mean, you're still Joffrey has already died and Melisandre states Tommen will be named king. Which why doesn't he just? Because they want to use another leech. Right. Yeah. So I mean, it's a bit.
They ran out of leeches.
Yeah, and then it's Davos want to dance. Then it's Davos want to dance a dance with dragons. So I mean, it's like wow. I mean, a lot is going to happen in between now and the next time you see Davos. And I think that's one of the reasons a lot of this stuff does catch you off guard is because it's all really told through us through Davos, and we miss out on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, and we have to take just like clues from Davis's POV about Stannis's psyche and draw conclusions from his decisions and his reactions. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are so obsessed with him, because we don't have the POV from him. And it's really fun to try to figure out that guy, because he's a tough cookie to crack, I think.
Yeah, because when do we, I'm trying to see here. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to see if like when that happens.
I mean, in many ways, Tywin's the same, right? Like,
yeah, so I'm trying to see real quick. So that chapter happens. Yeah, I mean, it's a while before that happens. It's like John 10. I mean, it was like when all that stuff goes down.
Yeah, it's going to be a while from now. Yeah, Stannis is a fascinating character because of the like with the psychic distance that we are from him. And I think Tywin is the same way. You know, Tywin's been dead in the series for what, 15 years, 2003?
Right. So we're like still 20 years reading through it. Yeah, but
yeah, I mean, he's been dead for 20 years technically, but people still talk about Tywin. Did he do this? Does he think this? Was Tywin ever a good dad? Blah, 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 blah. And it's because we don't know. We had to see him through every other POV and we never got one from him, which you have to decide as a writer which POVs you're going to show, and you have to make those decisions very intentionally. And because of that, you know, you can play with that, I guess. It's a tool to not feature them as a POV. Rob Stark being another example, which George has actually said he regrets. He wishes he would have written a Rob Stark POV. But honestly, I'm glad he didn't.
I think it's okay.
I like the way it is. I think Catelyn is fundamental to the themes of the story of motherhood. And also, you know, she has her own biases that we're looking through in her eyes. And I think it makes Rob more compelling. I think another Stark child might have been just a little too much.
Yeah, I agree. Whew. All right. Well, hey, that is a great chapter to talk about. And that's one of those ones we could break down for like 5 hours if we had the time for it. So with that, guys, I want to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we will be discussing A Storm of Swords, Chapter 37, Jaime 5.
We always love a good Jaime chapter here at Bend the Knee. And if you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com or bendtheneepodcast.com.
We'll see you next time. And remember that winter is coming.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best? You go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.